Welcome to the 9-8 interview, the home of all progressive and underground interviews right here in Australia. Now, we're doing something a little bit different this week. As some of you may know, I am involved in a show called Bakery Hill, an Australian Rebellion. And joining me on the show today is James Tredinick and Lindsay Call, two of the brains behind the show. Now, if you want to find out a little bit more about it, the relevant links, including ticket links, will be in the show notes below. But for now, enjoy this interview with two of the geniuses behind Bakery Hill and Australian Rebellion.
The 9-8 interview.
I'm currently on site here at the Brian Brown Theatre here in Bankstown, one of the southwestern suburbs here in Sydney. For those of you who have been following the podcast for at least some time now, you know that I have a small role in a stage play coming up, or musical actually, which means that for some of you who've decided to come along, you get to hear me sing, you get to hear me stuff up my lines. It's going to be fantastic. I've actually managed to sit down today with the musical director Lindsay and one of the writers and also one of the stars of the show, James Tredinick. Yeah. My apologies. We keep these things in.
First time it's been said wrong.
So we've sat down. We're actually in here before rehearsals. It's eerily quiet here in the stage, and it's actually quite fun. It's a good time to have a little chat about the show. Now we'll start with you, James.
Yes.
Being one of the writers of the show, or possibly the writer of the show, depending on how you want to do it.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration behind it? Why Bakery Hill? Why the Eureka Stockade?
I'm not sure. Look, it's the idea to do a show came first. Whether what kind of show it was, we weren't sure, but we knew Dad and I, who composed music together, we knew we wanted to write a show together. And then it just became about, you know, what's the show about? And we've both forever been fans of Australian history, and we knew that there were plenty of stories that hadn't been told properly from Australia's history. So we sifted through, and I think it was actually Dad who first mentioned the Eureka Stockade as a potential topic. Mm-hmm. And then I set to researching it, and the story just grabbed me immediately. Mm-hmm. And it became very clear very early that that was the story that we were going to tell. Mm-hmm. For so many different reasons, for the people, the relevance, the significance at the time, and just everything that the story encompasses and the events did and led to, it was immediately a story that we knew we had to tell.
Mm-hmm. And so when you said that it just grabbed you, for those of us here in Australia, most people tend to know what the Eureka Stockade is, unless you're, you know, keep forgetting about it, which a lot of people seem to for some reason. In just a few words, what was it particularly that grabbed you about the story? Obviously, the significance of it in shaping somewhat of our cultural identity, I suppose, here in Australia.
Look, obviously, I could go into all the boring nonsense about how it led to democracy in Australia and all the political side of things, but basically for me, I just love stories that are about people, especially ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, and I think that's exactly what the show is. It's about relatively ordinary people like the rest of us are, just put in a situation that is completely extraordinary and out of this world, and just how they handle it and how they manage to find their way through or not find their way through as the, you know, in a case-by-case basis, but just how their world was ripped apart by this fascinating turn of events.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you composed the music for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about, and I'll link this in with Lindsay as well, how did you go about capturing the essence of the goldfields through music?
It was something that Dad and I are really conscious of. Dad's been writing music since before I was born. He's been composing for years and years and years. And he had a whole bunch of tunes just floating around that I knew I wanted to grab and put in this show because I knew it was going to work. But for my side of things, I listen to a lot of country music. I listen to a lot of Irish folk music to try and get the sort of background that the people in the show had come from, you know, to try and further emphasize their points of view and kind of bring their worlds into the show. And then it just became about sitting down and knocking out some music that maybe and hopefully will be relevant to this story and to this show.
Yep. I want to pull in Lindsay here as well. Now, Lindsay's musical director. for the uninitiated of us, which admittedly is technically still me, being this is the first thing I've ever done in this sort of theatre, literally theatre, but also this theatre of the arts, musical directors, I mean, break it down. What do you do? You direct the music. I mean...
Yeah, so the basic job description that everyone who has attended any sort of performance would know of as the person who waves the baton and conducts the band. Mm-hmm. And that's on a very basic level. That's pretty much what I do. Mm-hmm. But for theatre, not only that, yes, you do look after the band, but a lot of the time is taking what James and Russell have written and teaching that in a way to a bunch of strangers so that it can become a musical. Otherwise, we're just singing songs for no reason. Mm-hmm. So most of my job is just making sure that people are singing the right thing, mm-hmm. that they're singing it in the right way, so mm-hmm. tone-wise, and also that they're not hurting their voice. Mm-hmm. But then I also go in and I hire the band and I book the band and conduct both aspects together for the show. But because for this show, we're brand new, I'm also orchestrating the show, which is making the music pretty much, so what you hear.
Yeah. So when you're doing that, I mean, I'm guessing the two of you collaborate somewhat in that, you know, you having written the music and you orchestrating it as it is. Is there a certain element of, for example, looking at historically what the music could have been around about that time and translating it across? Obviously, I have a little bit of an insight in the world in here. I'm hearing a lot of the music and so on and so forth for the first time, but also the orchestrations and such that you're putting forward. And to me, a lot of it seems to evoke the stuff that you might have associated with the Goldfields at that time, you know. So is that a conscious thought that you have when you're going through?
It's definitely all there that? In the back of my mind. From whenever I got booked and said you're doing a show about the Eureka Stockade, what were the instruments of the time? It's very Hamilton-esque in the terms of, like, we bring in the strings, but we combine it with a rock core, which is what we're going for now. But then it could also be in the keyboard programming. Like, do I use a upright piano, which is detuned as if it would have been in the Goldfields at those hotels? So it's bringing those elements together. So it's not just a concept album and it's not just a rock, like rock music that you would hear at a pub, but it's actual musical theatre, which the audience can relate to with what they're seeing on stage. They can also hear that relation.
Sure. I mean, there's plenty of sing-along moments, or what probably people would call sing-along if, you know, I'm hearkening back to the one sort of stage play that I know and love inside out, the Book of Mormon. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that that you can sing along to once you've seen it once or twice or listened to the album on repeat 95 million times. It is extremely well composed, obviously, to the both of you. How do you go about, I suppose, taking what is ostensibly on stage? I mean, we're staring at the stage right now. It's a big stage. It's probably, I don't know, 15 metres wide or something like that. Maybe 10 metres wide. I don't know. My spatial awareness is terrible. How do you go about using the music, I suppose, to make it seem bigger than it is?
That's a really good question. I don't know. We talk a lot about power in music and what makes music powerful. And at times, yes, it's wall-to-wall strings and two guitars and drums and just being as loud and as strong as possible. But a lot of times power comes from almost nothing. You know, there's a lot of moments in the show that are almost silent, you know, because that's part of it too. Because if it were just loud start to finish, you get bored. It's the same. You need variety. And yeah, I think in many cases, it's actually the quieter moments that are going to be the strongest. So you use it in that way. You know, you pick some moments and you say, for this moment, we really need to hit the back of the audience and hit them with everything we've got. But some other times the moment itself is strong enough that you need to pull back. Lindsay mentioned Hamilton before. And when you look at Hamilton's score, there are so many moments that aren't even sung. Mm-hmm. They're just simply spoken because they don't need to be sung. Because what's being shown to the audience is, it doesn't need to be overexpressed. It doesn't need to be oversold.
Yeah.
And that's a really important part of it, I think.
And a lot of that ties into what I have to do as an orchestrator by picking those moments in collaboration with everyone where we can allow the lyric to breathe. Mm-hmm. We don't just oversaturate it and have like a sonic sound blasting the audiences. We just have a cello and the right hand of the piano doing something, and that just gives us enough basis to not have it constant all the time. But yeah, it's very much just making those decisions. We don't want it to be rock ballads every single song.
That's
we
right.
want to save that for very specific moments.
Sure. And I imagine teeing into that as well, this is where the director, Ben, would come in as well and would liaise with you guys as well to say, well, you know what, this moment is a little bit more tender. Let's pull that back. You know, this moment's far more forward, so let's do something a little more chaotic, what have you.
Well, what's interesting about a show as original as this is that we don't have prior direction, prior music direction, any of that stuff to fall back on, saying they did it this way, so therefore we can do the same thing. We know it's going to work. Everything we're doing is fresh. Everything we're doing is a risk, basically. And a lot of that, we have to be collaborative in that way. We need to be open. We need to communicate with each other to make sure that, yes, we are on the same page. But at the same time, you can't have your finger in every pie. Mm-hmm. You just can't. There's too much going on. So you also need an enormous level of trust in everyone else in the team, which I think we have, which is great. Mm. Because, like, in the instance of Lindsay's off orchestrating, and we know it's going to be bombing. Mm. We just know that. Even before he sends us the file saying, what do you think? We know it's going to be fantastic, which is, as a composer, it lifts an enormous weight, knowing that what's
the weight to me.
That's right. Yeah, it takes it off my shoulders and puts them onto Lindsay's, which is fantastic. But, no, and it's the same with Ben. I know that Ben knows the script inwards and outwards and sideways and frontways. I don't know. He gets it. So even before he lets me know what he has planned for direction, I know it's going to be fantastic and I know it's going to work. Yeah. For that reason, when we're collaborating with what's happening visually compared to what's happening musically, it's as seamless as we can possibly hope for, because there's that level of trust and collaboration between the production team. Mm-hmm.
How much stuff do you change on the fly? I mean, I kind of know the answer to this, kind of, but I mean, a lot of the parts that I'm involved in haven't really had a lot of change, at least from, you know, the original scratch tracks that I have. Is it a case of Lindsay, for example, you might just be sitting there playing through it and going, you know what, actually, this would be really cool, and you sort of change it to, or does that work with the script? Okay, show it and it gets approved, and then, right, okay, we're changing it to this. Yeah.
Those type of changes are constantly sort of flowing through my head. So when I'm playing for rehearsals, I always have like a drum beat in my head.
Yep.
And there's something going, like, what is the bass doing? How can I make that on the piano? And I write it down and I try and do it later.
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes to music direction, but definitely for orchestration, a lot of it is just educated guesses.
Yeah.
Where you just sort of try it, and if it works, it's great. But then it's also trying to make sure that this epic guitar line you just wrote, does that fit with what's going on in the viola?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just trying to make all those educated guesses sound good and work together. In terms of our rehearsals at the moment, there's not really much I have to do in terms of educated guesses, because it's just a piano part.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the orchestration, I'm only hearing a demo track of instruments on the computer. It might completely change when we have a Zitz probe in a few weeks, which is when the cast meet the orchestra for the first time.
Yeah.
But in terms of rehearsal pianoing and running rehearsals, the only sort of changes we need to make is underscoring, and if something's a bit high, we can change the key and things like that. But most things are pretty stable at the moment.
And underscoring, for those who are wondering, underscoring is music that happens without singing. Music that usually happens under dialogue or under movement. Yeah.
Yes. So that can often happen with a middle of a song, for example. You might have two people talking and then they jump back into the song, or it might just be, you know, those welling moments like the end of Avengers or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that, because I had no idea what the fuck you were talking about either. So, I mean, veering off that a little bit, most of our audience is, we go out to quite a large international audience of prog heads. So they talk about progressive rock, progressive metal, you know, things with alternate time signatures, and, you know, Pink Floyd, Dream Theater, Tool, Cog here in Australia, Carnival, etc. And a lot of others that I'm sure I've missed. Please don't email me and tell me I missed your band. How would you go about selling something like musical theater to possibly one of the most snobby markets in the music industry, the progheads.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think now is kind of a perfect time to be making musical theatre. I think we're entering a renaissance of sorts. Lindsay and I have both mentioned Hamilton already, and there's a reason for that, because Hamilton really changed the game. It really opened musical theatre up to a wider audience, and people seeing Hamilton, hearing about Hamilton, and saying, well, I didn't know musical theatre could be that. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and I think that's opened the door for people like us, because people are starting to sit up and take notice and say, maybe musical theatre isn't all show tunes and Julie Andrews and everything that I thought it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe it could be different. Maybe it could be, yeah, maybe I need to reevaluate my my original thoughts about what musical theatre is. Mm-hmm. So, and that's really exciting for us to come at it, because we can write music that's not traditional musical theatre, that's not what most people would call show tunes. We can write a rock song, we can write a pop song, we can write a country song, mm-hmm. and it fits and it works, and that's okay. Mm. I mean, it's always been okay as far as I'm concerned, but especially now, it's acceptable to a wider audience, which is really exciting.
I suppose for me, and this is one of the things, when I first auditioned, I had that, you know, I'm a prog head, that's why the piece that I did for the audition was The Ballad of Sweeney Todd. Yeah. Odd time signatures, weird stuff going on, you know, the sort of stuff spoke to me. I mean, is the idea of it being ostensibly a two-hour concept album performed live, is that something that you could look at with this as well?
Yeah, of course you could. It's right from the start, it was written with the visual aspect in mind. It was always written so that it would work on stage as a story. And yes, there's dialogue that goes in between the songs. Still, I think if you were to perform it as a concept album, I think it would still work. I think there's enough variety in the music. I think Dad and I have put in enough differences between the music, and also Lindsay's orchestrations, like I said before, are absolute fire. Mm. So I think there's enough to maintain interest and to get the story across and to show people what the story is. Mm. But yes, it was always intended to be performed with the dialogue as a stage musical. Mm. Because, yeah, concept albums, musicals, there's kind of a grey area between them, but they are different. They are different things. Mm. And yeah, the intention was always for this to be a visual story as well as an audible one.
Mm. I want to pivot a little bit now. You mentioned that we're going through somewhat of a renaissance. You've both said that. A renaissance, to me, would probably require some kind of backing from a wider community as well. It's no secret that the state of arts in New South Wales is...
It's garbage.
That's a really polite way of putting it.
Trash before COVID and even trashier after.
Yeah. So how do you guys... I mean, is the end goal of this to get scouted by some knob from Broadway or something and then... You know, it takes off and goes international. I mean, is that the end goal? Is the end goal just to put something on? I mean, how do you get past that? You've both obviously got reasonably supportive families in that they, you know, understand the arts, they understand what you want to do and all that sort of stuff. But there are people out there whose parents maybe don't support that, and they do the whole, yo, you should get a real job, you should do this, you blah 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 blah. How do you combat that? How do you combat the overall overwhelming feeling of the arts in New South Wales being a little bit trodden on?
I think some things are worth the struggle. So it doesn't matter how much, especially last year, hit our industry. It's worth it because we know that that would end, and we'll be in a situation like we are right now where we're going to perform a really meaningful work, which has never been heard before to a couple of thousand people, I think. That's worth it alone, and also what's very worth it is the collaboration between people. Uh-huh. I spent all of last year working by myself. Uh-huh. It's just me and my partner and my cats, and that's how I got through the year. And all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by like-minded, incredibly creative, beautiful people, and that's worth all the shit that we get.
Yeah.
Or at least for me it is.
Yeah.
Like, I know that when we head into the shows and I start the click and we start the show, everything that happened in 2020, it doesn't matter because we're back now.
Mm. That's right.
At least for me, that's what it's like.
You look, on the family aspect of things, I'm very lucky because obviously my father is the co-composer of the show, so I know he supports it. My sister Laura, she is in the show as well. So obviously my family is very supportive of this particular path. But as far as the end goal, you mentioned the end goal, I think my focus is only ever this production. What's happening on this stage for this audience. Whatever happens after that is, well, it's out of my control. It's out of all of our control. And it's, so for that reason, it's not worth focusing on. But what Lindsay said about doing the show and being back and being able to make this work with these, with this incredible group of people. It is hard. It's exciting, but it's hard. But that's why it's worth it. Nothing worth doing was ever easy. If it were easy to do, there's no point to do it. And because it's so hard, that's what makes it so exciting and ultimately so worthwhile, I think. And yes, it's, you mentioned about New South Wales culture. We're very conservative and we don't support new works. We have a very, very long, unfortunate track record for only supporting works that have come straight from Broadway that we know have been successful. Whatever Disney's just put out or whatever show has been running on Broadway for years and years and years. So people will go and see those shows, but they will ignore the smaller shows like ours, which is incredibly frustrating. But it doesn't mean we should give up. It doesn't mean we should stop, because then we lose it. You know, and we don't want to lose things like this. We don't want to lose shows like ours or all the other shows that people are fighting to get off the ground just because there's a bit of resistance facing it. It's not fair to the shows. It's not fair to people working on them. And ultimately, it's not fair to Australian theatrical culture because we can do better and Australians deserve better, whether they know it or not.
You said in there that New South Wales people, but I think it's a wider Australian problem. People don't, realistically, Australians are brand snobs.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, if you look at the music industry, right, people probably aren't going to go and see, for example, there's a band from the Blue Mountains, actually, called Anubis, and they're fantastic. They're actually playing this weekend at the Baroque Room, I think it is. It's their album launch. Their album came out last year, and obviously we know what happened last year, so there was nothing that was able to be launched. You know, they've played multiple thousand festivals in Europe, sold out headline tours over there. They'd be lucky to get 20 people to the room here in Australia. It's really weird. I imagine it's somewhat similar in the theatre industry as well, in that if it was Hamilton, people would sell out. Well, Hamilton's got, what, waiting ticket list of like 3 months or something? Very hard to get people to something that they don't know about. It's almost like they're not willing to gamble it.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. And you're absolutely right. We are brand snobs, unfortunately, especially when it comes to theatre and prog rock and all these other things that kind of dwell on the fringes of our entertainment culture, which is a real shame because there's so much stuff that's worth hearing and seeing that people just don't know about for whatever reason, because people like us, we just struggle to get our foot in the door. I honestly believe that's all it takes. It just takes a foot in the door, whether it's an endorsement from someone that people will listen to, or whether it's, I don't know what it is, but we need something that will open people's eyes and say, well, hang on, maybe this is something I should take notice of. And not just for us, but like I said, for other shows and other bands and other acts of all kinds, because there's so much stuff that deserves to be seen and heard that just isn't, which is a real shame.
Absolutely.
All right, look, we're coming to the end of our time here. You guys have been very gracious meeting me here early and all that sort of stuff, so thank you for that. This is a question that I used to end all interviews with, and we recently changed it to something else that was a little more relevant to the, I suppose, the podcast itself and to the people that we interview. So I'm going to go back to the original one, and I'll modify it a little bit to the actual show itself, and that is, of the story of the Eureka Stockade, of the story of Bakery Hill, tell us something that most people wouldn't know about it. And there's probably a lot, but something that's really interesting that you've found about the show or that you've learnt through the process of researching the show or something?
I think what really got me, because I'm very new to the production, like in the past 2 months or so, whereas I had to learn everything very quickly to get up to this point. I think what's very interesting is that there isn't really a villain per se. It's very similar to Les Mis, where Javert is technically the villain, but he's not.
Yeah.
He's just a person who's doing his job. And I think this show is all about people who are just doing the best that they could with the circumstances provided to them.
Yeah.
It's not a Disney happy ending. It's not a Marvel evil alien person who is a very clear enemy.
Yeah.
In a way, everyone is their own enemy as well as they are their own savior. And I think that's very interesting, because that's something which I didn't know was really around in Australia. Like, I didn't, you know, you learn in primary school, especially here in Australia, you know, the gold fields and Eureka Stockade, you're like, cool. But you don't actually learn about the people. And that's exactly what this show is doing. It's giving it these people, these magnificent real life people,
yeah,
a chance for their story to be told.
Absolutely.
You know, we've mentioned Hamilton a few times and Les Mis, but that's pretty much what happens when you get a real story and you tell it the way it was. You don't bullshit and add extra things to it. And the reason they're very successful because of those reasons, and hopefully audiences here in Bankstown / Sydney will react the same.
Absolutely.
Because that's how stories work. Stories work, yeah, because we see ourselves on stage. We connect with the people we see. And no one in this world, no one is truly evil, I don't think. Everyone thinks they're doing the best they can. Everyone is just, like Lindsay said, yeah, everyone is just out there doing everything that they can do. And it's the same for the characters in the show. No one's bad, no one's good. It's just people being people. And good people make bad decisions, bad people make good decisions. That's just how it is. Villains. So Joss Whedon, probably the greatest screenwriter in history. Joss Whedon said, every villain is the hero of their own story.
That's right.
Which is a mantra that I try and carry whenever I'm writing. And there's even a line in one of the songs. The song is called The Villain of the Story. One of the lyrics is, the villain of the story never thinks that they're wrong. And that's kind of, I don't know, that would be the moral of this story. Gun to my head, if you had to pick a moral, that is it. The villain never thinks they're wrong. But someone has to be the villain. But at the time, you don't know it's you. And I think people will walk out of this theater and they will all have different ideas on who the villain was. And that is good. That's fantastic. That's what we want, because it's a bunch of real people who are sitting in the gray. They're sitting in the gray areas of ethics and morals, and that's compelling and it's fantastic. And that's exactly what we're hoping for.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for sitting down early. We're all starting to pile in here now, so we'll get to rehearsals. But thank you, and we'll see you, hopefully, half the audience here in the Street the City one. We'll see you in mid-April.
We'll be here.
Thanks, guys. Well, thank you very much to Lindsay and James for jumping on the show with me, two of the brains, I should say, behind Bakery Hill and Australian Rebellion, April 15, 16 and 17 at the Brian Brown Theatre in Bankstown. Adults are $45, concession is $35, and a group of 10 gets you $40 a person. If you are interested in supporting the arts, please come down and support all of us who have put a lot of work and a lot of time into this show. And thank you, as always, for listening to us here on the 9-8 Interview. We'll see you next time.
The 9-8 Interview.